monetary representatives of the office of the executive chairman who are here at our invitation. I'll explain how it came about that they are here today. And then good morning to all of you and other members. About two items on the agenda essentially. Besides the preliminaries, is a feedback from the office of the Auditor General on progress regarding the DOD's audit action implementation plan, and two is the military discipline bill. They will give you the feedback and an analysis of the public comments. We also outline the process. So those are the two items in the main that we'll give you in this meeting. So as for apologies, there is an apology from the minister. There's a cabinet meeting underway. There's also an apology from Nkosi Tshebekulu, an MP. He's also at another meeting. There's also that apology from Honorable Olumisa, was unable to attend. There is also an apology from the Deputy Minister, yes, and that his statement was closed. So we note that one as well. So those are the apologies for today, Honorable members. Without much ado, with respect to the first item for which we asked the office of the Auditor General to address us on, is the department's plan of action, which must deal with the issues raised by the Auditor General in his findings regarding the performance of the department during the past financial year, that's 2018-2019. You'll remember, or you'll note, colleagues, that for 2 years, 17-18 and 18-19 running, the department did not disclose capital work in progress as required, and some capital assets were incorrectly classified as inventory. The Auditor General also noted that intangible capital assets were not accounted for. Three, that irregular expenditure recorded lacked completeness due to the deficiencies in systems to prevent, detect, and record irregular expenditure. Four, of course, as you all know, are the special defense accounts issues. Essentially, those were the main issues that were raised at the AG. Let me say amongst the issues that were raised. And therefore, the implementation plan of the audit, the implementation of the audit action plan must tell us how well is the department responding to the issues raised in the audit, where the root causes identified and remedied, In other words, we are looking at whether the action plans were developed to address the audit queries, and if so, whether they were effectively implemented. Consequently, colleagues, last week, the portfolio committee resolved that we invite the Office of the Auditor General to give us a technical analysis of the department's attitude to improving financial reporting, compliance with legislation, internal controls, and risk management. This, in our view, will demonstrate the extent to which the accounting officer of the department is cooperating with the AG in resolving the issues raised in the audit, especially those that may again attract a negative audit. With that introduction, I now invite the Office of the Auditor General to address us on those matters. And Ms. Bali Zodetu will do the introductions. I guess is the one who will take us through the presentation. But you will hear that from her, and I'll hand over to Ms. Zodetu.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning to the representatives from the Department of Defense. The chairman has indicated my name is Mbali Sosetu. I'm the deputy business executive from the Auditor General. I worked on, amongst others, the portfolio on defense and military veterans. So today I'll be taking you through the briefing document wherein you highlighted the status of the records review that is performed for the Department of Defense up to the end of September 2019. So we look at half of the financial year to assess where the department was in terms of addressing prior audit issues. So, Chairperson, without wasting time, I'll go straight to the briefing document. On page 3 of the document, we indicate the introduction. So in the introduction, we mention our mandate as Auditor General, which is mainly to strengthen our current democracy by enabling oversight, accountability, and governance in the public sector through the audit work that we do in order to build public confidence. So the purpose of this document that we are presenting today is basically to brief this committee on the key aspects that we identified during the status of records review for the Department of Defense. I will take you through the purpose of this document as well at a later stage. We also indicate the overview of the Department of Defense and their mandate, as well as the objectives of the department. Chairperson, on page 4 of the document, that's where then we highlight what the status of records review is and the purpose thereof. So as part of our commitment then to assist the department in improving audit outcomes, we have for the past few years now introduced this document called the status of records review. As I indicated, we look at the period from the 1st of April 2019 to 30th of September 2019, which is 6 months of the financial year 1920. So the aim of the status of records review is to identify key concerning areas that may derail this department from making progress in terms of preparing a complete and reliable financial statements, performance reports, as well as ensuring compliance with legislation. So we then provide an assessment on the key focus areas that affect financial statements, compliance, as well as performance reporting. We also assess progress made by the department in addressing or implementing action plans and also commitments that they made in prior years in addressing the audit findings. We also, as part of this review, identify and indicate value-adding measures or matters that assist the department in putting actions that will address possible risks affecting the department. So assessment is basically a focus on looking at records that support financial reporting, performance reporting. So it's at a high level. It is aimed also at assisting the accounting officer to identify the barriers in terms of addressing the prior audit issues. So as part of this review, then we inspect financial statements, we inspect performance reports, trial balance, asset registers, and the like, which are part of what the department should have in place to ensure that there's reliable reporting. We also have discussions with senior managers who are responsible for those affected areas. So the matters that we highlighted in this report are not really audit findings, but are the insights that we identified whilst doing the status of records review. But we felt that it was appropriate then to present it to this committee to address the matter that you indicated when you invited us in terms of trying to find out where the department was in terms of implementing audit action plans. So the key focus areas that we looked at indicated in page 5 of the document. So it's those key...
Sorry, colleagues, we are making more documents.
So on 2.1 then, that's where we highlight the status of records review assessment. You will see that it's got different colors which are also explained. The green meaning the basics are in place, and then the yellow meaning is concerning, so meaning that you identify certain concerns for the key focus area. And the red meaning that intervention is required from the accounting officer in order to prevent audit failure. So you'll see from the summary that we've got quite a few areas that are reflected in the red, meaning that it is really concerning and intervention is required from the accounting officer to address those areas. Those are being oversight and monitoring, financial management, procurement and contract management, compliance, as well as IT management. The errors on that picture also show whether the status has improved or it remains unchanged or it has recurred. So you know that most of them remain unchanged, meaning that it has not improved, especially on the red ones, there has been no improvement. I will then now move to the detail for each of the focus areas. On page 6, we start off with oversight and monitoring. So largely oversight and monitoring was focused on looking at the audit action plans that were developed by the department to address prior issues. So we again highlight that it is key that departments do develop these plans, and monitoring also is quite important to make sure that these issues really get to be resolved. So when we did this review looking at the 6 months, the department was still in the process of finalizing the audit action plan. However, they were subsequently provided during December 2019. So what we are saying is that the department should then timely monitor progress made to prevent recurring audit findings, seeing that these plans were finalized most of them during December and the financial year ends in March 2020. So it will be key that there's adequate monitoring of those action plans. We also evaluated the internal audit function, which is there to highlight issues around internal controls in the department and report those to management for further corrective action. So in our evaluation, we identified that the internal audit function has not performed the 5-year quality assessment which is required in terms of the institution's internal auditors. However, they did indicate that they are now engaging with National Treasury to assist them in addressing this matter. So that's oversight and monitoring. And then moving on to financial management, which will then look at some of the issues that were raised as qualifications in the prior the chapter indicated at the beginning of the session. So the first one is on work in progress, which was one of the qualification areas in our audit report of 2018-19. So when we looked at the progress that has been made with regards to work in progress, we noted that the department has disclosed work in progress in the financial statements for the interim, meaning up to the 6 months of the financial year. However, our concern is that this is not the full disclosure as required by the modified cash standards, because it also requires that the department must disclose the opening balances, meaning the work in progress emanating from the previous financial years. There's also other narrative disclosure that is required to talk to the projects that are cancelled or that are suspended. So the disclosure, although we note the progress made by the department, however, the disclosure is not yet complete in line with the reporting framework. When we discussed this issue with management, they did indicate that they are aware of this partial disclosure. However, they were not able to make a complete disclosure because the template from National Treasury does not allow them to do that. So they are currently engaging then with National Treasury to amend the template to allow the department to make full disclosure. So the department should then ensure that that issue is finalized timely, so that when they submit the financial statements at the end of May, that complete disclosure can be made. So that engagement with National Treasury must be finalized before the submission of the financial statements. Chairperson, the other area of qualification was in relation to capital assets that were incorrectly classified as inventory and therefore not disclosed in the financial statements of the department during the 18-19 financial year. So during the time of this review, we noted that this matter is not yet resolved, so the department has not yet then disclosed those assets in the financial statements. We did meet with the department last month to discuss this matter, and in that meeting it was resolved that the department will meet with National Treasury to try and get clarity around some technical matters that they indicated were part of the reason why the matter is not yet resolved. I am aware that there was a meeting that happened last week with National Treasury, so the department should then have a way forward in terms of addressing this matter. We also identified another matter that is now outside the qualification areas, but as part of the review, we look at all other asset registers that are prepared by the department. This was in relation to immovable assets, wherein those registers were not yet completed and therefore could not be provided for our review. So the department indicated that they were still doing a verification to make sure that those registers were accurate and complete. So we were just highlighting this to the department, because if this is not finalized timely, it could also have a negative impact on the audit outcomes. Another matter that we identified as part of financial management relates to the letters of assist on new admissions, wherein we noted that some of the letters had expired. So if the department then does not have finalized letters on these missions, it does affect the financial statements in that the department discloses data in the financial statements in relation to these missions. But in terms of the modified cash standard, you cannot disclose the data or cannot recognize the data if you don't have the supporting evidence in the form of a finalized letter of assist. With regards to intangible capital assets, which was also an area of qualification in the prior year, we have noted some progress that has been made by the department in that they did submit some of the information that was lacking in the prior year, which also partly led to the qualification. So as we are busy with the interim audit, we are looking into that area also to see how far the department has really addressed the matter, but we have so far noted that there is progress in terms of intangible capital assets. So those are the key insights that we identified when we reviewed the matters around financial management. Moving on to procurement and contract management. So in the prior year, we reported various instances of non-compliance with SCM legislation, which then also led to irregular expenditure. So firstly, we highlight that the department does not comply with SCM laws and regulations, as I indicated, mainly relating to non-compliance identified in the previous financial year. And also the fact that the department has not updated the supply chain management policy to be in line with the new reforms that were issued by National Treasury. So therefore, that results in a risk that the department will not then fully comply with those new reforms, which will then result in non-compliance with SCM legislation and also result in irregular expenditure. So the update of the policy has taken a long time. The department is still busy now finalizing the update of the SCM policy. So we are highlighting that it is quite critical that that policy be finalized to ensure that it fully complies with the supply chain legislation. We also looked at the deviations as part of this review. So we looked at the procurement registers as well as the e-tender portal reports that were sent to National Treasury on deviations. So we do note that the department had reported on some deviations from the normal procurement process. According to SCM legislation, there are areas or there are factors that can result in deviation. So what we will do as part of the interim audit is to audit the nature and justification of the deviations to make sure that they are aligned with legislation. So at this point in time, we're just highlighting that there were deviations. However, we have not yet audited them to ensure that they are in line with legislation. In the prior, the department was qualified on completeness of the regular expenditure. So we identified that not all the regular expenditure was reported in the financial statements, and this was one of the qualifying areas. So in our review, we determined that there weren't any action plans that were developed by the department to address this area of qualification. So if this matter then is not addressed, it will then result in a recurring qualification in the current audit cycle. Chairperson, moving on to compliance management. In our review, we noted that the department has continued to incur irregular expenditure as a result of non-compliance with laws and regulations. In the interim financial statements, the department disclosed irregular expenditure amounting to 77 million. So, which again shows that there are still deficiencies around controls to prevent irregular expenditure. Another area that we reviewed was payments within 30 days, wherein again the department reported to National Treasury that they were not able to pay, to make all payments within 30 days as required by Treasury regulations. The department indicates that the main reason behind this non-compliance is because of the legacy systems that the department is using. The last point around compliance management is on investigation of irregular expenses and wasteful expenditure, which is part of consequence management. So during our review, the department has indicated that they were still in the process of investigating the cases of irregular excess and wasteful expenditure incurred in prior years, and that the report on these investigations will be provided to the accounting officer on the 28th of February, which is the end of this month. Moving on to IT management. So during the previous audit cycle, we also identified that there were significant control weaknesses in the IT governance space, IT security management, service continuity, and user access management. So when we reviewed then the action plan to address these IT audit findings, we noted that management was still in the process of addressing the weaknesses. And in some cases, the weaknesses were not addressed in the action plan, which could result then in these issues being prevalent again in the 1920 audit. Then moving on to financial health. So we note the reductions in the budget of the Department of Defense for the three financial years 1920, 2020-21, and 21-22. So these reductions will affect almost all the programs within the department, but in particular the special defense account. So we're highlighting that these budget reductions will then result in the department having difficulty in meeting its financial obligations, as well as maybe having to scale down on the activities of the department due to insufficient funding. Also, we know that because the department is labor intensive, most of the budget goes towards employee costs. And employee costs then account for 59% of the budget of the department. So on the 6 months that we reviewed, we noted that the department has spent $15.6 billion on employee costs, which represents 54% of the annual budget of $29.1 billion. So this already indicates that there will be a potential overspending on employee costs, which will then also result in irregular expenditure, as it was also the case in the prior years. And then the last area is key service delivery matters. This is also linked to the budget reduction in that it could have that impact on the department not being able to fully fulfill its mandate. Then lastly, Chair, we also then indicate that once we've presented this status of records review, we ask the accounting officer to then indicate the commitments that will be implemented to address the key deficiencies or issues that came out of this review. So at this point in time, we are still waiting for those written commitments. We did meet with the accounting officer as well as the defense staff council where we presented this document, and the accounting officer did promise to provide them the written commitments to address these significant areas that we are pointing out in the status of records review.
Chairperson,
that's our report. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the concise briefing on the status of the group. Okay. And the status of the implementation thank you so much, colleagues. This is where we are. You may want to comment. Please note that the department is not present today to deal with the issues that have been highlighted. We have an appointment with the department just to deal with the issues. But Brian, I don't see that appointment on the program. We said we must see them on the 26th. On the 26th of April. Remember, we wanted to see them earlier, and due to the what's called that day? The day of the 21st?
Because
they'll be busy, and we shifted it to the 26th. In other words, the department would be the accounting office will be here on the 26th to give us the third quarterly report, and then take us through the three-passenger focus with regard to the implementation of the audit. So these. In preparation for our engagement with the department, that is next week. All right? I wanted you to make you aware of that. And we are being told here that if the department does not address some of these issues, we are likely to get another. It's likely to get another qualification. And these are serious issues. I don't know how many times we pointed to that. So you then guide me as how we should deal with this at this point. But I now invite comments and colleagues. Honorable Mackay, Honorable Marae, Honorable Nkwase, and let me just take those. Yes, let me take those three and then to be better afterwards. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a point of clarification on financial management. It is said, based on discussions with management, the reason for the partial disclosure is due to the shortcoming in the reporting template provided by National Treasury. Just want to understand what that actually means. Because if there's a template that is supplied by National Treasury, and that makes auditing of the department difficult, but Treasury may work hand in hand with the auditor. Just to understand what does that actually mean. And then the second thing, it is said that the letter of employment from the UN mission has expired. See, usually when you are South African, then you think maybe some other people in the United Nations are more professional. How does it happen that something expires and who is to blame? I'm not sure whether that is the right question to the Auditor General, or should this one go to the department itself. It's very surprising, or how can the UN be so unprofessional? Just to extend or just to give them a letter, or it will be very interesting to understand what actually is happening here. And then just a comment, it is already clear that the department is going to get a qualified because of certain overspending on employees. There's absolutely nothing the department can do about it. And maybe if I was to understand the template, the question of assets and inventory. I'm not sure whether it's already, or how is it going to be sorted out? Because Treasury or the Auditor General would say the engine of a jet fighter is an asset. Defense would say this thing we are going to get rid of it is inventory. So I think something of that nature, if I understand it very well. And so it means if they still, maybe that is what the template is all about. If it is still that way, it means still is a qualified report. And how do we look at these things? Because we are already looking at a qualified audit report. What do we do about it? Thank you, Chairperson.
Mr. Marae, after Marae is Mr. Kwase, after Kwase is Matthias, after Matthias is Shemek.
Thank you, Chair. My apologies for arriving late. I want to touch on some of what our colleague has just said. The first one is again about that point three, financial management. First of all, it refers to a template. Now, obviously, I assume that if that template was not correct, the Auditor General will also qualify the National Treasury. Because, I mean, how can you allow them to use templates that is not correct? So it, you know, and I want to really request, because we have to determine where's the problem. Is the problem with National Treasury, or is it the problem with the interpretation from DOD? And you can just, you know, that's my immediate assumption. If there's a problem with the template, you must have a problem with the template. And you must qualify them, because then they are not putting the various departments. And this will not probably then apply only to DOD, but to everybody else. So that's the first point. The second one, also on that three, you've referred to capital work in progress that was not disclosed. Do you have information of, and I know that there are some of the capital projects that is probably classified or that's, you know, confidential, but are those Hotel Biro and Hoefijster, or what other capital projects are we talking about? Is it capital projects outside that? Because we are aware of that ongoing capital projects, and we're not sure whether that is part of what they have then included in their reporting. The whole matter of, and I want to support my colleague, the whole matter of how you define capital assets and inventory, surely there must be a way of amicable way of finding a solution between what you, I mean, there's not nuts and bolts. It might be, like you said, it might be an engine. And now, is that a capital asset or is it an inventory? Because your inventory is normally, as I interpreted it, you need someone, something, you go from the, you know, the storeroom, hypothetically, you take it from the shelf and you put it into the aircraft. Now, is that a capital asset or is it an inventory? And somewhere along the line, surely, it's not that difficult to interpret these things. I know from the past chairperson, the department has reported number of times in terms of how they operate as a defense force and how they see equipment being used or parts being used, and that it is not capital equipment, but the National or Auditor General is seeing it as capital equipment. So, and I know that they have said in the past there are the circumstances of the Department of Defense and the SNDF is different from another department. And it seems like there's not a way that the Auditor General and they can find each other. I'm raising this because it means that we will get every year, based on things like that, they're qualified, and we will at the end say, qualified is not really an issue. It's more a matter of different of opinions of the same thing. So, and if we can't get to a point and we can put really value to a qualification, qualification means nothing. Yes, I mean, we're aware it's going to be qualified, but we say, it's anyway, we're never going to reach a amicable solution, that we will never get a situation where it will be unqualified, purely because these two parties don't see eye to eye on certain things. And I mean, you might say, yes, tick box, we have done our job. Tick box means nothing to me if it's not corresponding with effective service delivery and making a difference in terms of the constitutional impairments. If it doesn't matter, I mean, then you're not doing your job either. Because you can design a thing that you can tap yourself on the shoulder. So what? Get a bonus and get over it. But at the end of the day, we must serve what we are supposed to serve, and not just make you look good or the other party bad. We must see what the difference is. Then on the point five, the updated asset register only for 19, for that period 1 April to 30 September. Are you convinced that the asset register then before that date is proper? Can you verify that the department knows exactly the assets that they've got, including especially immovable assets, properties? Can you confirm that you know that? Because I know that we have had discussions. And my understanding is the department doesn't really know how much property they've got. What is in their name, what is not in their name, what they are the guardians of, and what the Department of Public Works are the guardians of, and what they are under 99, like in Durban where they've got it under 99-year lease agreement. Are you convinced that they know exactly how much land and property they've got, because some of those land will be freed up and hand over in terms of expropriation to South Africans. Do you know that? Can you confirm that, please? The other thing is, on the point six about the UN, I again want to support my colleague. We know that the UN made a resolution to extend their financing to MONUSCO forces, of which we are, and South Africa is a critical part of that. So we know that. We have seen those confirmations. So are you saying that the UN has not sent or sent written confirmation? If that is the case, Chairperson, then we will have to liaise with DIRCO and our representatives at the UN to then make inquiries as to why they don't confirm after so long. I mean, you know, that's a critical thing. The other thing I want to ask you on that matter, you have elaborated a bit more about debtors' amounts. How do you determine a debtor amount? Only when the debtor confirms that, or in a normal business you would raise an invoice. So whereas the Department of Defense has so-called raised the invoice to say you owe us money, but it seems like according to that you don't say it's a debtor. You want a confirmation of the debtor that it's actually a debtor. It seems like you don't look and see the service has been rendered, an invoice, a so-called invoice has been raised, you don't see that as a debtor. You must please explain to me in terms of accounting practices why that is not a debtor. Then on, again, the procurement, and I want to reiterate what has been said to us about the defense environment. And I think we have even discussed it with yourselves in the past, in terms of previous reports. So somehow we must just not, you know, run around the same block with the same times, using the same words, using the same phrases, using the same problems. So what? That's my response. But sometimes, so what? What now? It seems like, you know, are you going to enforce certain things that is impractical for the Defence Force to comply with, purely because someone said it must be like that, and they might not have taken Defence Force's circumstances into account, and you say, I don't care about that. I only look at what is on black and white, irrespective of the practical implications. I need to understand that, and I know it's been a recurring thing that we have said in the past. And that linked to point 10 as well. So these things are intertwined with each other. And compliance with management, you know, these things talk to each other, and So, Chair, that will be my point at this stage. The financial health is something that is not, but it shows very badly. Thank you.
Mr. Fassel, Matthias, Shilembe, and then Peters in the matter.
Thank you, Chair. I think for now I'm covered, and then most of the questions will be referred to the meeting on the 20th, because mine is mostly on compliance, and it's really with the accounting.
Thank you so much. Matthias?
Well, thanks, Chair. I agree with Mrs. Fassel. We all agree that the military is a highly command-oriented, command-led, and hierarchical structure. I don't know how high are the gentlemen before us in that hierarchical structure.
They're not here for the culture. They're here for the military, the military discipline.
Okay.
So we have an appointment in the department for this on the next week.
Okay.
We are just taking this preparation for that meeting.
That be the case, I agree with Ms. Fassel that we defer the matter for that meeting with appropriate relevant representative of the department.
Thank you so much. Honorable Chairman.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine will be, on 2.2, that commitments from the accounting officer. Just if I look there, it says the status of records review was presented to the accounting officer and senior management of the department. We requested commitment from the accounting officer to address the matters emanating from this review. Now, seeing that, the current irregular expenditure is sitting at $77 million due to non-compliance, and this needs an urgent attention. If it is not attended, urgently, so something, we may say the irregular expenditure, skyrocketing. I just want to know from, your office, when was the status of the records review presented, to the accounting officer? And and I want to know whether the accounting officer has responded to confirm commitment in order to quickly stop the skyrocketing of the irregular expenditure, because while we are talking here, we don't know how speedily it is taking place there, that irregular, and the $77 million now is something that is very, very huge. If at least if I can know when they were presented, and are there any commitment already to your office to say they will quickly, to find out from there. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you so much, Thank
you, Chair. It seems to me that the only commitment that the department was making was on the one of creation. The only commitment that I saw. But nevertheless, Chairperson, the auditor general are already busy with the interim audit, but the department is still in process to finalize the audit action plan. What I want to know from the auditor general is, what is the percentage of the work done on the audit action plan? And my second one is on compliance management. The irregular expenditure relates to prior and current year cases. But did the department report on the status of consequence management, or what is the status of the investigations of the prior year's cases? Then, Chairperson, my last one is on procurement and contract management. They don't have an updated ACM policy in place, but what is the status of the work done on updating of this policy? Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Mr. Mati, do you want to have a second part?
Yeah, just a follow-up, Chairperson.
To your earlier question.
That's right. point number 11 on compliance. If we could get to what is it all about? But what is this all about? Is it something that can be sorted out, or maybe, just to have an understanding. We're giving you on a 77 million out. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, I support it.
Thanks. Right, I think that takes care of the questions of clients. And I know some of the questions that have been made, you may not be able to deal with them properly. We ask for the department to respond to them. But you indicate where you will have a difficulty and you then pass it on to them.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you very much for those questions. I will start with a question on work in progress. there were some comments and questions being made. Firstly, you have to explain what does that mean, that there's a shortcoming on the template. So how the template is structured is that it's an Excel template, and then it's got lines. So under capital work in progress, it will show different types of assets. So in the template, it does not have the line for specialized military assets. So it could be that it was an omission really from National Treasury not to include specialized military assets, because this capital project that we are talking about results in specialized military assets being disclosed in the financial statement of the department.
Okay. Can I come in on this one? You'll recall that the department was never considered the issue of disclosing capital work in progress as its responsibility. They thought if Auditor General wants information on that must then go to AMSCO. Okay? It was out of our insistence here that you must reflect it in the books. So it means it's only now that they are starting to develop, together with Treasury, the template that will enable them to disclose fully all the capital works in the project. So I think we Africa should just indicate that. You may continue.
Thanks, Chair.
I'm too old fashioned. can I just understand, or my little understanding is that all they need to do is to press a button and put another line and just write specialized to augment the template. That's my little understanding.
Yeah.
Do we need to, maybe let them make me understand how can it take 6 months if this thing is in a computer?
Mm-hmm.
Where you have got to press shift, open space, and then you write whatever I can do. Is it not that simple?
Can I just say, remember, that is not DOD's responsibility. That's National Treasury. And that's what my question is. So if you are going to be hard on DOD, you'll have to be hard on National Treasury.
No. The responsibility is with the Department of Defense, and it's the Department of Defense that must seek whatever help it needs.
Look at here.
No. I hear you.
A reporting template by National Treasury.
I hear you. Why not? The department must then come back to us as to how far they are, you know, progressing with Treasury in terms of developing the template. All right? Maybe let me be that. I said it's the first time that they're doing it. And it's expected that there will be delays in coming up with the template. So I think we must leave it at that, but let's hear what the department, how far they've gone in terms of, getting Treasury assistance in finalizing the template. Mr. Martin, you are right. They would have to explain it to us. You are old school. I thought you were going to say you. On the chalkboard, you simply just throw a line and add whatever you want to add. Okay, we'll have to explain it. I think it's sufficient for us to know the intricacies involved. And
thank you, Chair. I think Honorable Mare is right to say that we should also follow up with Treasury as well, because they are the owners of the template, and we've done that from our side as Auditor General. We do meet with National Treasury from time to time to discuss technical matters that affect a lot of departments that we audit. So in this case as well, we did take this matter up with National Treasury, and they have agreed that they will address this matter. They will amend the template to ensure that the department is able to make the full disclosure when they submit their financial statement.
Yeah. But the question goes beyond that. If they don't do it in the next year, would that qualification shift away from the department to Treasury?
not, it doesn't
change. Okay, that's a problem.
Okay.
Pass the buck.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, we'll have to try and marshal both departments to get this right. And yes, over to you.
Thanks, Chair. Then the last matter, I think our underway in progress was the capital project that are running in the department that should be part of the disclosure on work in progress. Chairperson, I'm not in a position to mention the project because, like other member indicated, some are classified or confidential. So yes, it is a number of projects, some that you mentioned, but I cannot at this forum indicate which one is the same. But we will do a completeness check when we audit that work in progress that will be disclosed in the financial statements. Then there were also some comments on the issue of employee costs to say that already there would be overspending and that will then result in a qualification. I just wanted to bring clarity to say that the overspending does not result in a qualification because it doesn't mean that the financial statements are not accurate and complete. It basically means that the budget that was allocated was not sufficient for all the expenditure that was incurred by the department. But the impact is that that overspending then will be part of irregular expenditure. And if it is correct, it is so that as was in the prior year in the financial statement, then it does not result in a qualification. Then, Chair, moving to the issue of assets and inventory, I think there were quite a few comments on that. To say that what are these assets, what is the criteria perhaps to identify what qualifies to be a capital asset versus inventory. Chairperson, the modified cash standards as issued by National Treasury clearly indicate which significant spare parts will qualify as capital assets. So in auditing these capital assets, we do apply that criteria that was developed by National Treasury and is included in the standard. So it's not really our prerogative to determine what defense should classify as capital assets, but it's in line with the standard. And also I just want to mention that the department has developed a position paper on capital assets versus inventory. And this position paper very clearly also identified these key or significant items like the engines, the propellers, the rotor blades, and then such. And in their conclusions, on most of these items, they mention that they do acknowledge that these items are in fact capital assets. However, when it comes to disclosure, they didn't disclose these as capital assets, even though in the position paper they came to a conclusion that these are in fact capital assets. So we have had a lot of discussions with the department to really find out is what is the reason sitting behind the non-disclosure if they have really concluded that some of these items are capital assets. And really the focus was on the significant items that they've also highlighted in the position paper. This matter was also escalated to National Treasury now as owners of the modified care standard to say they must also provide their view because the department did provide them with a position paper where they really looked into details of this capital asset. From our side, we've met with National Treasury and we got to a certain understanding around these significant spare parts. However, the department still has some issues or technical matters that are indicated earlier on which they want clarity from National Treasury. So they indicated that once the clarity is obtained from National Treasury, they will then address this matter, meaning that whatever then needs to be disclosed as capital assets, they will disclose as such. So there is some movement, it's just that the time, they must just be aware of the time to say that we are already now 1 month into the end of the financial year. So the matter then needs to be resolved before they submit the financial statement. But I think there is some progress in terms of getting to an amicable understanding to appreciate what the standards disclosed as a capital asset versus what needs to be inventory. So in terms of our discussions that we've had so far with the department, I think there was some progress in terms of getting to that understanding. So they must just then finalize with National Treasury those other technical matters.
Chairperson, Sri Lanka didn't get used to doing this. It's a wish to disrupt this. Like what we see in So I just wanted to understand, meaning that the Auditor General and Anin Gay, whether there's a discussion paper between the two of them, whether they written amicable or whatever, then you are going to qualify it. None of your business.
Yes.
You're talking to Treasury. So, whatever they do, then you are going to tick according to the template that you have. Is that how it happens? Because if that is the case, if I was DOD, I wouldn't worry.
Exactly.
You wouldn't? I wouldn't worry about the qualification.
Exactly.
Because I'm negotiating, and this is business with Treasury, we disagree, and the qualification wouldn't have any weight. Don't you have something that you can write or okay, I won't qualify them, they are still talking, I'll qualify them next year if they don't agree.
But then they have to qualify both.
Something of that.
Well, unfortunately, Chair, we can't write that there's still negotiations in progress. But honestly, let's know, Chair, the department has reached a conclusion on some of these items. A lot of them, they've reached a conclusion to say it's an asset. But they have not disclosed it in the financial statements as such. So that's our argument. Last year, when we raised this finding, we considered the position paper. We indicated to them that these are the items that you concluded on your own, that they are capital assets, but why are they not on the financial statement? So that's where the argument
that's
is
valid.
That's valid. Chair, I'm moving to the question on number 3 regarding the properties owned by the department. I must say, from the previous financial years, we haven't raised any significant issues around the completeness of the properties. So I think from our side, we were happy with the completeness thereof, but we will consider what the honourable member is saying to say that perhaps we really need to look deeper into the completeness of what the department is disclosing as their properties. Thank you. Then the other question was on the UN letters of assist. I may not have all the details on this one. I think the department will provide clarity. But our understanding is that the department enters into these letters with the United Nations regarding the assistance that they provide in certain countries. And so even in the prior year, we did determine that there were certain letters that had expired. So how that affects the financial statements is that in the modified cash standards, you only recognize a debtor based on a contractual commitment or contractual arrangement. So you will not necessarily recognize a debtor because you provided someone with an invoice, which is contrary to the accrual basis of accounting. So in modified cash, it's quite crucial that you must have that contractual commitment. So the lack of this letter of assist with the UN then takes away that contractual arrangement between the department and the United Nations. So as a result, it means that you cannot then recognize the data. However, there is another way of disclosing that in the financial statements, but it cannot be a data. It cannot be seen as a data. You can disclose it as part of receivables not recognized. That's how it's termed in the modified cash standard. So our argument with the department was that they were raising them as debtors already, whereas we are saying that where you don't have this contractual arrangement, then you can show it as a disclosure, note in the financial statement to say it's a receivable but not recognized.
Chairperson, just clarity on that. Just clarity on that. My understanding is that the UN do not get into a contract with the Department of Defense of South Africa. They enter into an agreement with South Africa via Durka.
Sorry, is that correct?
Because, I mean, that's how I understand that.
I'm just finished.
And then when there's revenue streaming, it doesn't go to DOD. It goes to international Treasury's revenue fund. So, I must understand there whether DOD is actually contracting with UN or was it via DERCO?
Chair, I think I'll have to come back to you on that one. But my understanding of the letter of assist, I think there could be an overriding agreement, but there's still a letter of assist that will indicate the final details of the arrangement to indicate, say, the number of helicopters that will be used and all of that, which will then result in the revenue that will be received by the department. So I'm not sure what are the other details that are in the overriding agreement, but the letter of assist then brings it down to the details.
But you see the difference between what we are talking about now, contractual arrangements.
Yeah, there would be a contractual arrangement and service level agreement.
Yeah.
The service level agreement between the department that is rendering and the United Nations.
I don't think so.
Maybe let's flag that for the department.
Yeah.
I think it's fine for here for now.
Yeah.
They didn't say it's sufficient.
No.
Thank you, Chair. Then I'm moving on to issues raised around procurement and contract management. There was a question around the status of the policy that is being updated by the government. So in our last engagement with management, they indicated that they were at finalization stage of the policy. So it has not yet been approved, but it's currently being finalized. And then there was a question or a comment around impractical cases to say, as AGSA, are we using the same standard for all departments? Because there may be cases where defense, maybe in particular, is not able to comply. So do we impose those impractical cases on the Department of Defense? Chairperson, the legislation that we use is the same, and it's governing all departments in the country. However, National Treasury does have certain cases of prerogatives where the department can deviate from certain procurement processes. But there is a criteria of when can you deviate. So before you deviate, then you must indicate why it was impossible or impractical for you to comply. For instance, if there's an emergency, even that emergency is also defined by National Treasury to say these are the cases that we consider to be an emergency. So in those cases, then the department can motivate and approve a deviation. But cases that are not justified then should not then result in deviation. So when we audit, we do take that into account. Then the question on the cases or the instances of irregular expenditure that make the 77 million, Chairperson, I think the department then can provide that list of instances that resulted in the irregular expenditure. And then there was a question on the status of investigations into irregular expenditure. As indicated in this briefing document, we don't have the report as yet. So the department only indicated that the final report will be provided to the accounting officer next week. So at this point in time, we cannot really be able to indicate what is the status on those investigations. Lastly, Chair, there was a question on the commitments from the accounting officer. To firstly ask when did we provide this document to the accounting officer. So the document was finalized early December and was provided to the accounting officer early in December, where we asked for a meeting to engage the accounting officer on the document, the status of records review. We then presented the document to the accounting officer on the 27th of January, the accounting officer and senior management of the Department of Defense. That's when we also asked for commitments then to address the matters highlighted in the document. So at this point in time, we still then waiting for the accounting officer to provide those commitments in writing. The question around interim audit to say the, what is the percentage coverage. So we're looking at the financial statements, the interim financial statements that were submitted in October. So the coverage is looking basically at the 6 months, but we also look at other audit areas outside the financial statements like the compliance. So we are already looking at compliance with FCM legislation. And also performance information to some extent. So, yeah, that's my answer to that part on the coverage of the interim audit. We are finalizing this interim audit on the 28th of February. Thank you.
Okay. Colleagues, that takes care of all the questions members have actually raised. And I know Majid would still like to have the last fight on this one. Thank you very much. Yeah, but my perhaps the question is where to from here. And but before I get to that, let me recognize Majid.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Just to understand, if this has been submitted at some other time before. I heard you saying something about October also. Has there been any change in what you submitted to the department, or is it still the same?
Thank you. Thanks, Chair. So when there were subsequent changes, this document was submitted in the first week of December to the department. So where there were some changes, I've already highlighted them in the report, for instance, the action plan that was submitted subsequent to us submitting the report. So that is factored in. However, I want to indicate that as we are busy with the interim audit, then that's when we'll do a real test of what is the status now of the department, because that's when we will issue findings now if really there's no progress in addressing the issues. So this was at a high level because we looked at certain records and then determined the status. So once we finalize the interim management report, that's where now you will give you the real facts to say these were the findings that came out of the audit, and that will tell you what is the status now.
So this is early warning. but then it depends on how the department is responding to some of these issues. Remember, a lot of them are recurring matters, and that the department has not been addressing for at least 2 years. I mean, 17, 18, and 19. And if they don't get addressed in now, it means that the 19, 20 will attract the same address opinion. So that's where our concern is. But so where to from now? We're meeting the department next week, and the interaction is between yourself and the accounting office. I don't know the extent to which the minister is brought into the room. I want to assume that she may not be up to date with this, so that when we meet with her next week, it is not an ambush. Probably we need them to summarize this document and bring it to our attention to say these are matters that the committee would engage you on and want some clarity so as to assist the department. So the department must not get into the same problem that found itself in so far as the audit is concerned. But you want to say something on the minister's knowledge of where the issues are?
Thank you. After we've discussed the document with the accounting officer, we then also sent it to the minister for her attention and also requested a meeting with her to discuss some of the details of the document.
Has that meeting happened?
No, the meeting has not yet happened. The minister is not being available for that moment.
All right. So, we will leave it at that. That's fine. So, thank you very much for the presentation. It has certainly enlightened some of us. So, it will even make our job easier when we interact with your audit report later in the year. Yeah, because we are now aware of the issues. So with that, colleagues, so do you still want to ask to meet with when you said you are right now preparing the final, is it an interim report? Would you want to come back to us on that, or we should take this as sufficient and then wait until you present the final? Because it's not going the internal report help us in, you know, it would already be late. The horse would already have bolted. That's the point I want to make, for any intervention to happen between then and the time when you produce your final outcome.
Can I just say, Chair, my understanding is, yes, you report on the past, but there's also lessons to use going into the future. So in other words, if we wait for the final audit, then there's no real impact that we can have on the financial year starting on the 1st of April. But if we can have a final interim report, that can certainly assist us in making sure that the department in this new financial year 2021 can implement that, and we can certainly look at those things, because if we wait for the end of the year, then it's gone, we know, then it's history.
If we wait until we receive the report, it will be October.
Yeah. Then it's gone. Then the financial year is three quarters gone. Then there's no impact on the 2021 financial year.
I see. And how readily available are you in terms of sharing the internal report?
Chairperson, as indicated, we're finalizing the interim management report on the 28th of February, so we submit it to the accounting officer on that specific day, and then we need to engage the accounting officer on the report. And thereafter, then we can share the summary of the items emanating from this report with you. So I'm thinking that maybe around the second week of March, then we should be able to share the report with you, and also maybe some highlight on the other entities in the portfolio as well.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Let's conclude on that note, that we'll then schedule another meeting with the AG. First or second week of March, depending on the calendar, where we now receive, the final update on this, and also I think you'll also be looking forward as well. All right. So, colleagues, let me thank the AG for now, and then say thank you and wish them well as they take leave. Thanks. We now go to the second Second item. Colleagues, can we discuss the process on this bill that is before the committee? Process first. And, Brian, Willem, Peter, what did I say should be the process? Who still can remember that? Peter, can you talk to the process from now?
Okay.
No, please just grab and sit down. Just grab and sit down. It's fine. I don't have a problem. Nice. Peter, what did you say it should be the process? Remind me from now and in our meeting.
Yesterday, what we said is the first thing we should do is after a presentation on the submissions, like I'll be doing now.
Okay. And when the bill was published for written comments, and the closing date was when?
The 7th of
February. Then you take it up from there. Yes, Peter?
And then you see the 7 submissions. I've summarized them, so I'll present on the chair. Next week, Vilayalam will present an analysis of the bill, mostly clause by clause. And after that, we'll have the public hearings. And after that, we'll give an opportunity to the department to brief us.
All right. And then give us the dates when those public hearings are going to be.
Chair, good morning, members. Chair, we had agreed that the hearings would be on the 3rd of March. We had initially programmed the 3rd as well as the 4th. But then we felt that due to the number of people that have submitted and that have indicated that they will be available to give verbal briefings, people that have indicated availability, it's only 3, we then felt that the 3rd of March would be sufficient for us to engage in the public hearings and then utilize the 4th for the clause by clause to be done by the department.
Yeah. Okay. So you can hear that clause by clause presentation. The one that Peter Villem will do will just zoom in on key areas of the bill, right? But that is for the 2026. Okay. He's doing the analysis of the presentations. Villem will actually do an analysis of the key clauses of the bill, right? All of that is in preparation for members for the public hearing that is on the 3rd, right? Preparing members so that when the people are before us, we are then able to engage with them, you know, ask questions of clarity. It's part of equipping ourselves. Then on the 3rd is the actual public hearing. So far, 3 institutions, 12 persons have indicated to come before us to do an oral presentation. And then on the 4th, and it's now the department taking us through the bill clause by clause, right from clause 1 to the last clause. All right? And then on the 11th of March,
on the 11th of March, we had indicated that the department will be responding on issues that have been raised in the submissions.
All right. So how we want the department to deal with it? You'd say to us, this is the submission from A. On clause one, they are saying this. This is what we are saying. And then we'll make our own decision. On clause two, they are saying this. This is what you are saying. And we'll make our determination. Because it's something that we concede. You'll simply say, on clause three, we concede. I think they are making a point. So on clause four, we concede, but with this amendment. But on clause four, on clause five, we think this issue is adequately covered elsewhere. See clause Y and Z, you know. So in other words, it's an opportunity for you to respond to the comments. Bullet by bullet. I want to use that because I'm dealing with that. Bullet by bullet. All right. So that's the opportunity. That is for the 11th. Okay? So it means that you have from now until then to prepare for this. And so you'll be with us on during the public hearings, because some might on the site as well. So because some matters will require you to take notes, because they may not be in the written submission. Alright? And then when do you finalize the bill? We'll then decide when we finalize the bill from there. Okay? But the 11th of March paves the way for us to finalize the bill. Alright? And are you happy with this process? Does it give you sufficient time? And it's your role adequately carved out in the process? Over to you. Thank you so much.
Good morning, Chair and
Honourable
Members.
Sorry, let me just please just introduce the team. It's Major. I knew it's Nancy, but I was actually looking for the rank. When I grew up, I was in the mood to call Sergio. So I don't have to make that mistake. So over to you. Just introduce the colleagues and then submit your presentation. And the comments on it.
Thank you. Good day, Chair, and the Honourable Members and my colleagues. Sir, I'm Major General Eric Munisi, the Adjutant General of the South African National Defence Force. On my immediate left is Captain Moekwa, who's working in my office. We make sure so that time and again we introduce the young men and women to whatever that we do, so that when our time comes, they can definitely take over. This bill will definitely affect them more than me. So on his left is Lieutenant Colonel Mashiko, who is the legislative drafting in my office in our division. And then on his left is Major Malisa, also the person that we introducing in our processes, is also working in our division, specifically in my office. Then having said that, I want to thank you very much. Thank you very much.
So there is also a state law advisor. Mr. Sean Padweda.
That's correct.
Just for the completeness of the introduction, so that he was not recognized. Now over to you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. First of all, I want to appreciate the opportunity to appear before and intimate before this open house, so that we definitely do the business that we have to do. I remember I was here and recently, and you promised that you want to speed up this process, members want to speed up this process, and indeed we delivered on those promises. Hence why here, sir. And I want also to confirm that we will live with this MMA program, sir. Then it's our major issue. Then if there's anything except the court of law that competes with this, then I'll concern and then make sure that no, we are here and we are here. Thank you, sir.
No, no, thank you so much. Colleagues, I don't see anyone from our legal section. Have they been invited this time?
Chair, I interacted this morning with Ms. Lutz to ensure that they were here. She advised me that they are aware of this meeting, but then it could happen. In fact, she also advised me that she has now been moved. She will no longer be dealing with this being particular, but she is on the defense amendment. But then she also indicated that it could be that the person from the, our legal section will not be available, will not be available today. Think that this is purely for us to go through the, because that person will have time for themselves to also go through the submissions. But then she committed that Mr. Nakil Jemani has now been sent to us to deal with this bill. But then moving forward, we will be available.
Sure. I'm happy to hear that. And Peter, over to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair, members, colleagues. I've added out the PowerPoint presentation. I was hoping it will be screened, but there's a problem with that. So what I'm going to do is basically just go through the various submissions. As you can see there on page one, the bottom, there were seven submissions, one from the Reserve Force Council.
Sorry,
Emergency
General.
So if I may have a pleasure of having the copy, and that I can work.
Why did you have the copies?
I prepared the copies here, and for now it was only for vacancy.
No, can you share this with them? That is all from government.
Budget has been cut here as well.
Venom doesn't have a copy there?
No.
All right. Okay, because I feel to be dealing with the general thing. Please, enough copies. How many copies, Major General, the name from the side school, please? Okay, all right, sure. You go ahead. Okay, you can start this to share this one. All right. Okay, I'll start this for now. All right, so you may then take us through.
Thank you, Jay. So there at the bottom of page one, well, now there were about seven submissions. The first one was from the Reserve Force Council, and the second one from the Ministerial Tasking Investigation, the Sexual Exploitation and Abuse in the Defence Force, the SEA, and there's submission from Mr. Thompson, the fourth one, the Director of Military Prosecutions, and then the fifth one there from Colonel Hanan and his colleagues, the sixth one is from Brigadier General Machila and Lieutenant Colonel Van der Meek. And then the last one there is Dr. X. We still need to get a legal opinion as to how we're going to address that specific submission. That one was submitted in terms of the Protected Disclosures Act. So we're getting a legal opinion on how we should proceed with that one, and then we'll take it from there. On the next page on top, you can see one of the surprising commissions, well, there was no submission from any military trade union. I'm saying this especially in the light of SANDU's African National Defense Union, and the many times they've and the department has been at loggerheads. So one would have thought that there would have been a submission from SANDU. Next day, one will note that two of the submissions, the drafters said that they are willing to come and make verbal presentations. That is the Reserve Force Council and then the Ministerial Task Team. So on the next slide here at the bottom, there is just a brief overview of what the various submissions actually outline. And one will note there at the bottom, first one, the one from the Reserve Force Council. The first concern was that there were severe time constraints to make a full submission. And they actually requested that they make a final written input by February 28th. And I think the Secretary is in contact with them. They are busy preparing that final input. More importantly for our purposes is that they state there they have not been consulted on this version of the bill as required by Section 48 sub 4 of the Defence Act. And if you want to go to the memorandum of the bill on page 1, you will note under consultation, it states there that various consultations have been conducted with the Department and the Reserve Force Council. There is another issue that we are actually investigating, and we also requested a legal opinion on that as to how we should proceed with the submission of the Reserve Force Council.
That's the reason why we thought we should get legal guidance on that one. It's because it is by law that they must be consulted on the development of legislation, policy, I think in other regulations. From the law. Now, if they say they've not been consulted, then we don't know what happened that put on our way. But we are also aware that they were consulted in 2012. The question was whether is this the same bill that was in the making that they got consulted, or then this is a new bill redrafted and all that. But you will then take us through. No, that was just to address a particular concern. It is a concern because an important stakeholder and is recognized as such by the law.
Can I suggest this, Chair, because that's a serious allegation. Because if that is true, then it means that, you know, we are misled and being lied to, which I do not expect from the DOD, but that is the nature of this allegation.
Sure. Right, they'll deal with it.
Serious.
Yeah. At least those can be dealt with now, because they are just on the process, they're not on the substance of the bill. All right, thanks. Over to you, sir.
Just for reference purposes, the submission of the Reserve Force Council, that specific issue is raised in paragraph 2, where they state the council and the statutory body representing the Reserve Force of the SNDF has not been consulted on this was as required by the Defence Act. Chair, the next issue there at the bottom of page 2, that is the ministerial task team on sexual exploitation and abuse.
So we've extended the time for an input. Given them until then?
Today.
Today, by April. In other words, that is still coming, eh? Alright. Then on C, the task team on sexual abuse and
exploitation and abuse. Basically saying that one of the aspects of the mandate was to make input into the military disarmament bill. They are prepared to make a verbal presentation, and then most important for us is their input is aimed at possible changes to the bill that will assist in dealing with sexual violence in the SNDF. The overview of the next submission.
Can I just ask on that? I mean, surely that I agree that's very important, but it cannot only be a verbal presentation. Surely they must give us a written submission, because eventually we must make sure that there's no lost in translation. So if there's specific issues around SIA that they want to see in this bill, then it must be a written submission. Really, it's strange to me.
Chair, all seven submissions are in the pack. I'm not sure how they are ordered, but it's in the pack. And there is a written submission from the material task force.
Yeah, it's in the track, and they are requesting to do an oral presentation in addition to the written presentation.
Oh,
this one.
Okay. Hello, Chair.
Chairperson, before we can proceed, can we please allow the presenter to go through, and as he goes through each slide, we take note, we highlight whatever he wants to have, and at the end of his presentation, then we ask. Otherwise, the presentation becomes bad and disjointed. So let's avoid intervening or interrupting me as he goes about
Thank you, Chair. On page 3, the top slide, there is a submission from Mr. Thompson. And one should note here, besides the two first submissions from the Municipal Task Team and from the Reserve Force Council, these submissions that follow are all from within the department. And Mr. Thompson is making submission there. Firstly, he's saying that there was no consultation of inputs provided to the internal stakeholders of the BOD. He also then questions the understanding of the Military Command Council regarding the defense force in the democracy. I think this relates to some of the issues that will later, I will refer to later, that the view is basically in conflict with the Constitution, especially the Bill of Rights. And the next issue he raised is whether costing has been done to implement the bill, because he's aware that there are no such funds available in the defense force. And one also note in the memorandum to the bill, also on page 111, the department says that there are no financial implications to this bill. And an issue that is basically mentioned in all of the submissions is the appointment of the Judge Advocate General. And we'll come back to that later. There's another presentation or submission from Directed Military Prosecution, and they raise various issues. One note, for instance, there in Chapter 8, they talk about the issues of constitutionality, and there it deals, for instance, with the issue of the right to legal representation as well as sentences, but more detail there later. The other presentation is by Colonel Fernand and his colleagues, and he also states, or they also state, that this version has not been distributed internally in the department. And he says that only some officers were involved in a need-to-know basis. The other issue he raised is that the bill is unnecessarily voluminous. And one notes that there are about 13 chapters, 3 schedules, and around 111 pages. And then they point out that once you go back and find out what is actually the object of legislation, and that is to establish institutions, state functions, prescribe the composition of powers and duties and rights of all incidental matters, when necessary offences are created and penalties are determined. So they believe that some of these issues should actually be either dealt with in regulations or in amendments to the Defence Act. Next, they say that the wording, the drafting, the form and the style is not always desired standard, and it's not consistent. They say it also doesn't comply with good legislative drafting principles, and requires extensive refinement. So that is the view of Colonel Fernand and his colleagues. The next submission is by General Magilla and Lieutenant Colonel van der Niet. That submission is about 111 pages long, and they state that this is the first opportunity for officers in the SNB to engage with the analysis of the bill. And again, as for the Electoral Council, the submission is not exhaustive because of time constraints. And they state also that they don't have interest to make a presentation, a verbal presentation on the board. And then you can see the various issues that they are raising. The last one is by Dr. X, and that's about 52-80 pages. And as I said, we'll wait for the legal opinion to decide how we're going to take this forward. But they also state there that the bill seriously encroaches on the powers and the role of the secretary as a counting officer. It overreached by including PSAP officials and members of the public under military rule and justice.
And again, as other submissions, there are elements of unconstitutionality. For instance, the appointment of the judge president, the judge advocate general, who makes the appointments, the issue of suspension of privileges, and they say there that the constitutionality of what is envisaged in this clause is highly questionable. So if we go into more detail on page 4 of the PowerPoint presentation, there one have the specific issues that the Reserve Force Council is raising. So the first four issues I've already raised. So if one look there at the bottom, what the issues are that they are raising besides what they said before, is first they ask whether the SAPS and correctional services has been consulted to the extent that it actually affect, they are affected by the bill. And then they make a suggestion there, the object of the bill should be reduced to provide, I quote, to provide for an effective administration of the military justice system and the maintenance of discipline in defense force, and to provide for matters connected herewith. On the next page, one note, the issue of the commissions, and this runs through all the various submissions. The Reserve Force Council refer to around 92 definitions. With some they agree and say it's correct, and others they say are not correct and it needs to be revisited. But what you can see there, some of the definitions they refer to is appropriately qualified, camp, civilian court, the whole issue of department, and more than one submission also refers to that, because the bill actually refers to Department of Defense and Military Business, and they say that this bill is only specific to the Department of Defense. And the reference is only to be made only to the Department of Defense. They said that the full title of the Geneva Convention should be written out, and then they refer to a definition of legislation, a degree in law, national security, armed service, superior officer, etc. More important for our purposes is the bottom slide, where they refer to the object and application of the Act. And they say that those clauses, there's 2 G, H, and I, they say should be omitted as they are alien to the subject matter in the clause and belong in the Defense Act. As it was said earlier, they say some of these issues should actually be in the Defense Act or in the regulations. And those issues relate to administrative discharge, the functions, the appointment, the powers, for instance, of the Provost, Marshal General. And then I refers to the right of the Minister of Defense and the OCs, you know, to control access to military property. The next one is for the application of the Act, and they refer to Clause 31C, and they say, they should actually say, but why is this change necessary? They amended something there of to who the Act actually applies, and they also refer to people that are detained. So the Reserve Force Council asked me question that, and clause 31E refers to MSDS, and they are saying this distinction is superfluous. Chair, on the next page 6, the top slide, the first three issues I have referred to. So we come to overall comments. And they state there, they confirm the structure of military courts and state that it's critical that checks and balances should be put in place to protect the independence of these structures. Concerns here relate to the military judge being outranked by an accused, and the strict criterion that only internal candidates can be considered for the judge advocate general position. The next one, they say, it commends that the rights of parties to review and appeal a decision of a military court should be strengthened, and they recommend that review and appeal clauses should be reviewed to ensure there are no misinterpretations, and suggest such processes should follow that of the civilian court. And lastly, they recommend that these sessions should create an obligation to consult a victim in cases where the alleged perpetrator has been acquitted. The next issue, Chair, and I would like to refer members to the presentation itself, because they actually go into quite a bit of detail of the issues that they outlined. And the first thing that they say is that the victim's charter should actually be made part
of this bill. And we know that the Dictum Charter for Internet has around 7 principles, and I think those are important principles that should be actually captured, you know, in the bill. And those rights refer to the right of a victim of crime. And it relates to the right to be treated with fairness and respect for your dignity and privacy, the right to offer information, the right to receive information, the right to protection, the right to assistance, the right to compensation, and the right to restitution. So they say that the victim charter should actually be incorporated within this bill. And then they're also referring there to the concurrent jurisdiction of civilian and military courts regarding sexual offences. They say there's a bit of a contradiction there, and it needs to be sorted out. More important is also then the suspension of members charged with sexual offences. They say there that the suspension of members with serious allegations made against them is often delayed, as well as the uplifting of sanctions. They say it's crucial that victims are encouraged to come forward and then that they feel protected. Because if a member has been sexually assaulted but has to continue, you know, working with the perpetrator for a lengthy period, then this actually becomes quite undesirable. So they say the bill must be aligned with this. The next issue is just basically then the holding of superiors of officers to conduct or for failing to report cases. They say they are concerned where allegations are made that superior officers delay the complaints, ignore allegations, or actively protect the accuser, and this needs to be addressed. The next issue is just with regards to the budget. They say several of these sections in the bill implies budgetary constraints. For instance, transportation of witnesses, the creation of posts, and the training, you know, of members on these sections. So, again, the issue of budgets. Important also is the command and control function. And they say they do understand, you know, the importance of command and control within the defense force. But they say where there is a level of distrust, particularly when it comes to trust in the way in which the SNP handle complaints of sexual harassment or offenses, it is critical that victims are allowed to report matters outside of this. And that is strictly forbidden by this bill. So, indeed, that is concerning if the bill then prevents that. And then this is referring to other links to other acts. I say the bill actually provides the opportunity to link up with other acts, such as the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Act. And then they go on and make suggestions as to some definitions that should be included, and one will note with the last submission as well, you know, they propose that the definition of fraternization should be included, sex worker prostitution, comrade, sexual harassment, military assessment, as well as firing. Here on page 7, the bottom slide, there refers to section 45, and that's about furnishing of particulars of trial by a civilian court. And they applaud this creation of this section to ensure the exchange, you know, of information on convicted SNDF members. However, it's unclear how the sections can be implemented if the DNA fingerprint database of the chef is not linked to that of the SNDF, and they said, you know, this should be done, and a budget should be created for this. The next one is just powers in respect of prints, photographs, and samples of accused without a warrant. This section provides for taking thereof, and then it goes into detail with regards to the issues of deployed soldiers in the DRC who fathered children, you know, and they've now been raised in the DRC, and they say that there should actually be a cross-reference, you know, to the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Act to consider the taking of samples of paternity cases that were brought before the taking of samples from deployed soldiers in order to assist the children born in the DRC as a result of the deployment of soldiers. The next issue relates to declaratory orders. They say
it sets out what would happen if a military court convicts an accused of a sexual offence. And it says that this includes such offender be removed from any functional environment involving children, learners, etc. But they conclude that it's concerning that the bill must provide for a situation where a person who has been convicted of sexual offence still remains in the employ of the defence force. So they're raising concerns with regard to that. And the other issue is just about military order, policing capability and crime investigation capability. And then they refer to this issue that it's at the discretion of the chief of the SNDF to ensure that capabilities of military police. She said that this is actually, this should actually be an obligation, you know, because without proper capacity of the military police cases, cases cannot be properly prosecuted and the impact on the victim could be severe. And then an issue that comes out very strongly in this presentation is Schedule 1 and Schedule 2, where they say that Schedule 1 makes provision for penalties up to 30 years imprisonment. And this can actually be contrary to the Minimum Sentence Act, and that just needs to be looked at. The next one is just about concerns with regard to sexual exploitation and abuse should be contained in the main act. So what I'm saying, sexual offences should not be in schedule, in the schedule, it should be moved to the main act, and the definition should also be captured there. Because for now, it's like as if it's an afterthought, and it should actually be captured in the body of the act. The last section, sir, just referred to Schedule 2.8, and then this section lists the prisoners to good order and military discipline, and it refers to what a possible definition of fraternization, and then they list those. And what they're saying is, it is concerning that this section of fraternization between consenting adults is placed in the same list as between persons where power relationship exists and the potential for abuse is very high. He said, submitted to any form of relation that has such a power imbalance should be treated differently and placed in the bill itself or in Schedule 1. The abuse of learners and the ordinance is reported significant challenge within the defense force. So that is with regards to the submission by the ministerial task team. If I can move over, Chair, to page 8, a very short submission by S. Thompson. Raising the issue that there was no consultation, and whether this bill has been costed, and then again, as I said, you know, raise issues with regard to the judge advocate general. Stating there that section 174 of the Constitution, you know, states that the president should appoint judges, but this bill provides for the minister to appoint the judge advocate general. So questions are then being raised about the appointment criteria for the judge advocate general, and the impression is created that the criteria we take were tailored to suit the current advocate general. And then lastly there, on that slide is clause 28.5, states that the salary of the judge advocate general must not be less than that of a judge of the High Court. Again, questions are raised related to how this was determined. On page 8 at the bottom is the next submission, and that is from the Director of Military Prosecutions. The first question they ask is, why doesn't the bill address the creation of two new directorates, namely Director of Military of Administration and Justice and Director of Research and Development, and they say that the bill should actually address it. Again, one will find that there are various definitions that they outline, like for instance the issue of chaplain, and I think this is an important issue because one will note in the bill that a chaplain is basically picked at a lower level than a second lieutenant, but when it comes to disciplinary issues, he's viewed as the level of a colonel, and I think that is one of the issues that needs to be addressed, because that the bill itself doesn't allocate a specific rank to the chaplain. On the next page, page 9, the top slide. It's something that we referred to earlier, and that is the sexual offences in the RFA are tried by civilian courts, and they suspect that the bill is actually changing this, and that is something that needs to be looked in. And then clauses 11, 12, and 13 do not address the dissenting views among a court of military appeal. So basically a panel for there, and if there's not, you know, yeah, if they don't agree consensus among those sitting there, they actually don't accommodate the dissenting view there. And also with the court of senior military judge, that's the same concern that they are addressing. Clause 21 relates to assessors, and they say they require guidance for such an appointment. And then clause 25.1, I think, is also being raised by other submissions. And that is when the accused is no longer in the service of the department. It says that we need, they need to clarify exactly how this is going to be dealt with. The next one deals with the jurisdictions of courts, because they say that often in the run-up to the case itself or the hearing itself, and that is during pre-trial, you will find that there are irregularities, and that actually impacts on the jurisdiction of the court, and that is something that needs to be looked at. The next one, clause 26, equates the period of default to the days the accused actually evades arrangement. You know what arrangement is? That's when the accused is basically brought before court, and then the charges are being read to him. So they say there is not clarity, you know, or a clear distinction between these two different functions. And then there's an inquiry to be done in conjunction with the Ethics Committee. I couldn't find any reference to the Ethics Committee within the bill, so maybe they can also enlighten us, you know, what is this Ethics Committee, where is it designed, and how it's actually composed. Clause 83 and 84, they contrast sections 35, 10, 12, and 13 of the Constitution, something that I referred to earlier, you know, the right to legal representation, and their sentences. And they feel that those clauses actually impact on that. So again, they say it's an issue of unconstitutionality coming to the fore there. Clause 104, as they say, extend the right to review to the state as well. They go on and then say it's various issues that they raise with regards to Schedule 1, like clause 18.2, malingering, you know, where people basically fake the sickness and so on. He said they should just be careful that this can actually also relate to mental illness. And then offences relating to military courts. He said in all particular offences should immediately be tried in court. That is where you show contempt within the court itself, in presence of the court. So he said it should be dealt with there immediately. The next one is about conduct prejudice to military discipline. Saying that it's vague and it's undesirable. The next one relates to offences under customary international law outside the RFA, and they feel that this should not be an offence. And then participation in peaceful and unarmed assembly demonstration. You see this clash with section 49 of the Defence Act, as well as chapter 20 of the regulations. And then I think chapter 20 relates basically to the constitutional judgment that defence force should accommodate military trade unions and the rights of them and so forth. Clause 58, that's basically, you know, when a person occupies a military house, for instance, is prohibited to sublet, you know, prohibited to do certain business there, but then the fine is really excessive. You know, it says that it shouldn't exceed 15 years. So they feel, you know, the sentence is too heavy for the offence. 62, and that is failing to report civilian court conviction, and this is just making a suggestion there that it should be changed from the current 48 hours to at least 14 days. The last slide under Director Military Prosecutions on page 10, the top slide, is Schedule 16, and that relates to computer-related acts of misconduct, saying that pornography also includes child pornography, which is a serious offence. And this clause gives the impression that such serious offence may be tried in a disciplinary forum. And we know what our jurisdiction with regards to a disciplinary forum. And then acts of misconduct relating to driving of military vehicle. He said this is a serious offence and can also be tried in a disciplinary forum. The next submission was by Colonel Kerman and his colleagues. And as introductory remarks, something that I said earlier, you know, is the luminous, the wording, the drafting is a problem, it doesn't comply with good legislative drafting, etc. But more important, they say there at the bottom, it must be emphasized that the bill in its current form, and even previous versions, especially since 2017, was not distributed internally within the due to illicit comments and inputs from the relevant stakeholders. Only some officials were involved on a daily basis. Check again, definitions, various definitions are outlined that they have a challenge with. You know, as indicated earlier, for instance, with regards to appropriately qualified chief of the defense force, you know, they are using a definition that is different to that definition in the Defense Act. Military veterans, you know, not being part of the Department of Defense, etc. The next slide, Chair, it also regards to definitions, and it just needs to get more clarity on officer commanding and a commanding officer. There are differences and needs to be clarified. And also, they're not sure why the word uniformed member, who is the director in the legal services division, given that there's only one director, you know, why it should be described like that. And then also one, the operational deployment, you know, to be narrowed down, because it's wider than what is actually contemplated in Chapter 3 of the Defense Act. And then there's for the prescribed issues, rehabilitation of labor, and then, you know, the military law practitioner, and I think this is an issue that is going to come up quite a lot. You know, when does a person actually qualify to be a military law practitioner? What kind of qualification that person should have? Several of the other submissions actually refer to that as well. Because what we find is there's a reference to LLB, but say, you know, BProc and VA law and other legal degrees or qualifications also be acknowledged at this current application. Page 12 on top, they're just making a reference to various clauses that they think need to be jacked up, like for instance the object of the Act, you know, as it relates to administrative charges, access to bases, conflict with other acts, you know, the clause is not ideal, you know, clause 5 there, and it's not ideal for interpretation and needs to be sorted out. Clause 7, limitation of the jurisdiction of military courts, and they say there that the word president should be replaced by parliament. The next one is clause 10, offences under the Act. So the purpose of that clause is not very, very clear. And the last one there, on that specific slide, is the composition of jurisdiction of the courts of military appeals. They say the word must shouldn't be included. The next one, on page 12, the bottom clause, is the powers of court of military appeals. It says the reference to the word contemplated is superfluous and confusing. Prescription of offences, it said it should also refer to offences committed outside the RSA. So what they say there is military discipline offences, with regard to that, it is silent if it should be dealt with inside or outside of the country. So that is something that I think we should also then follow up. Clause 27, he says not, it's about the prohibition of a double jeopardy. He says not sufficient to provide that the person may not be tried again on a charge based on the same offence. What about a charge based on any fact that formed part of the charge he was tried on? Change something that I referred to earlier is the issue of the judge advocate general. You know, there are various issues that has been raised with that, so I'll skip that. And then on the slide, the bottom slide on page 13, it is just there, clause 13, they say the power of the minister in respect of assignment of functions Just saying there, it is not clear what right is actually envisaged for the judge advocate general. I think currently the advocate general is a major general. So you just want to know about what right does the bill actually propose for the judge advocate general. And then termination of appointment and assignment, they say that any military legal practitioner in court, including the judge advocate general, may administratively be discharged after prescribed procedures. So all those other sub-clauses actually should be deleted. And this is a very interesting one, clause 36. It relates to assignment and functions of local representatives of the JAG. He says, why would the appointment of a local representative be of someone who has at least 12 years experience with that, when that of the JAG is supposed to be 9 years experience? So they just think that those issues should be realigned. And then the general duties of the military judges and the senior military judges, they state there it should be emphatically provided that military judges or military courts for that matter have no jurisdiction with regards to the invalidity of unconstitutionality of any law. So they can pronounce themselves with regards to constitutional court. I think it should go to the ethics court. The next issue, Chair, it deals with the top of page 14. It's just raising issues with regards to civilian courts, the problem in respect of print and photographs, investigation, receipts of findings, adjustment of fines. There's also an interesting one, clause 92, it's saying that the Adjustment of Fines Act prescribed fines after passing of some time to correlate with prescribed prison sentences due to the inflation. So no apparent reason why that act should not be applicable to sentences by military courts as well. The next slide on page 14 in the bottom, it deals with correctional centers, military prison, military correctional facility. It says they should provide for regulations regarding military correctional and detention facilities. A provision must be made for the repeal of Section 82 of the Defense Act. Then they just go to various other issues there, like the right to review of trial or declaration, the right of prosecution to appeal to the Court of Military Appeals, the composition jurisdiction of military disciplinary prescription, and then Chapter 11, military disciplinary hearings. Chair, may I skip through some of these because it's quite a long presentation from Colonel Ganat and these. Important, Chair, is for me is on page 15, the bottom slide. There is clause 151, and that's suspension of privileges. He says the constitutionality of what is in this clause is highly questionable. How can it be justified that a person be withheld from service benefits when he or she has not been convicted? Even more questionable that a person who has been penalized as a result of conviction is burdened with actions that effectively add more punishment. And then also pension and privileges. He says the proposed terms favorable personal action privilege must be defined for what it is, because this could be open to abuse. For instance, no suspension without pay. And then no provision is made for the application of the alternative of some principle, you know, near the other side, since these proposed actions may be severely prejudicial to a member. And this action clause must surely be revisited because it appears to be unconstitutional. I'll skip the top slide on page 16. On page 16, the bottom slide, just with regard to discipline in other military offences, and especially offences relating to uniform decorations and medals. And that is something that we've addressed in the Defence Amendment Bill. And they are also referring to that. And then also this unlawful use of DoD premises, issue that is also mentioned before. And then important is this issue of dishonesty and plagiarism. That's clause 18. And they say that it's not clear why this conduct is criminalized, so this conduct could be dealt with in terms of common law, for instance, with regards to fraud, you know, as is currently the case. Because plagiarism in itself is not a punishable offense. So they say the sanction also appears to be very excessive. He says imprisonment for a period not exceeding 10 years. And that is for dishonesty and plagiarism. I think reference most probably made to, you know, people going onto courses, you know, and where these things take place. And the punishment just seems to be really severe there. Chair, if I may move over to page 19, that is the last submission, because I don't think we should discuss the submission by Dr. X, since we are waiting for a legal opinion on that. So on page 19 on top, there is a submission by Brigadier Bajila and Lieutenant Colonel van der Meet. With regard to the heading, they say that the name of the act is a misnomer, because the bill relates to the concept of military discipline, which is far wider than provided for. They propose amending the title to Military Justice and Related Matters Act. With regards to regulations, the general regulations, they say that the term regulation should be used rather than general regulations. And then the terms rules in the heading clause 162 must be changed to rules of process and procedure. With regards to the preamble, it says the bill does not provide for the maintenance of discipline in the DOD, because this is actually a command function. But I think that is also a contested issue there, as how much of this should be put into the bill. And they propose there that the preamble should be changed to those specific wording there. And that is to provide for military justice system in the defense force in support of the constitutional imperative that the defense force must be structured and managed as a disciplined military unit. So there is an alternative preamble proposed by the submission. And then the next one is appointment versus assignment. And it says the bill does not establish and regulate the appointment of judicial officers and court officials. Judicial officers and court officials are assigned and designated. So they say that those words then should be changed. On page 19, the bottom slide relates to military policing powers, the function and duties to be captured in the preamble. It says the bill and draft regulation provide for military policing powers, the function and duties of the Chief of the SDS, Pro Forma Marshal General, and the military police officials. It says if these provisions are retained, it should reflect in the preamble, because and it should refer to the amendment of the Defense Act 2002. Issues that I think should be included in the preamble are the following, because they basically omit various aspects in the bill. So they recommend the inclusion of the establishment and regulating of military discipline hearings, military policing functions, the repeal of the Defense Act as provided for in Schedule 3, and not just the Military Disciplinary Supplementary Measures Act, and the repeal of the rules, and then amendment of the Defense Act. Chair, there on the next page, the top slide, there they just give us a revised preamble, what I think should be in the preamble, and then also, you know, the deletion of the Defense Act. You seem to be careful there, because the total deletion of this act will cause deletion of sections 104 to section 112, which are still operational. So just a word of caution there with regards to the deletion of the Defense Act. And I suggest that such provisions should be included in the current draft and provide for a specific draft to rewrite clause 162. The next chair is just the definitions that they are referring to. There are various definitions that I think need attention. But on page 21, the bottom page, again, issues with regards to the just advocate general. And similar issues that have been raised by other submissions. And then the first one there deals with the qualifications of the judge advocate general.
saying that the appointment requirements for the JAG is prescribed in clause 228. The JAG only needs to be appropriately qualified serving officer who has been admitted as an advocate or attorney of the High Court and with not less than 9 years' experience in the administration of criminal justice. So it's possible that an officer in the reserve force who is not a military legal practitioner, who does not have any experience in administration of military justice, and is a practicing advocate and attorney, can be appointed as the JAG. So he says that the absence of a qualifying criteria relating to the experience of a military legal practitioner is of great concern and should be reconsidered. And it's also unclear whether JAG has to be an MLP upon appointment as a military legal practitioner an appointment as a judge advocate general, because it seems not to be the case, as he or she must only have served 9 years as a military legal practitioner. And then this is a concern that has been raised by other submissions as well, that the bill by implication provides that the judge advocate general will provide legal services. And they say the implication is that he will not be able to perform his or her duties under this bill unless he's a practicing legal practitioner in terms of the Legal Practice Act. It does not provide for the administrative aspects, and therefore provision of clause 28.5 should be deleted. The inclusion of sub-clause 5 begs the question why the drafter only provides for remuneration conditions of service for the judge advocate general and not all voluntary legal practices, if the drafter deemed the bill to be correct vehicle for providing for remuneration and conditions of service. On page 22, sir, it is just various selected additions that they are proposing, and the first one is with regards to the object of the bill, the second one is access to the High Court, and then the third one is this access and exit controls paragraph. The bottom slide is a duplication, so we can go to page 23, the top slide. Again, selected additions, continuing on the previous slide, access and exit controls, unlawful occupiers, and this is also very interesting because it brings up the issue of Merivale, what happened there. So on page 23, the top slide, unlawful occupiers, states there that unlawful occupiers of military property or premises, especially housing facilities, is opposite and affects service delivery. In order to address unlawful occupiers, that's now civilian or military, consideration should be given to the inclusion of any occupier of or resident in military property and premises. And then they also say there, the next one, reference should be made to the Legal Practice Act, to ensure that the legal practitioners are accountable, efficient, and independent. The next slide, at the bottom of page 23, just saying there that they should add Correctional Service Act, because there it goes about, solitary confinement, as a form of punishment for offender. And this was viewed as unconstitutional, inhumane and degrading treatment. Consequently, though the Correctional Service Act now provides in section 30 for segregation for particular purposes and only for a limited time of period. The bill, however, references the sentence of solitary confinement at 10 different instances. So I think there is something that also needs to be looked into. And it says that in light of the constitutional development that occurred in the field of correctional service, there is a for instance. So the penultimate slide, page 24, it just also selected the additions. And then it's issue that we referred to earlier, that is Jack. It's not required to be a serving military practitioner. And then also they, know that a legal representative of JAG must be serving a legal practitioner while the JAG actually is excluded from that. And then also important with regards to the judge advocate general is the salary and terms of conditions of his employment. And there is now, in terms of section 52 and 55, of the Defense Act, and then the reference is actually to the current Adjutant General's condition of service. It says, through the bill, the drafter is seeking to regulate the Judge Advocate General's salary and terms and conditions of employment.
The bill is not aimed for this purpose. The approach is irregular as the drafter links the Judge Advocate General's remuneration to, you know, that of a High Court judge, while in fact he or she may not perform any judicial function. And then the last clause relates to this clause actually contradicting any sentence proposed under clause 84 of the bill that may affect the Judge Advocate General's salary reduction, etc. On the one hand, the bill provides choice that his salary cannot be reduced, but on the other hand, there are clauses where it indicates that the reduction and rank has an implication when an officer is sentenced to reduction in rank and that offender's salary or benefit is not determined by his or her military rank, his or her salary and such benefit must be reduced. I'm just saying there's a contradiction. On the one hand, we have the Judge Advocate General salary for the service of provision that cannot be touched, and the other hand, you know, others subject to the bill, you know, may be affected by it. Chair, that is the submission. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Peter. You did very well in your analysis. It's quite a lengthy bill, and we are really thankful to all those who took out their time to make the submission. We were even thankful to some of the members, to your colleagues. They may have not done what you may consider usual or ordinary, but I think at least it's some of the processes that the inputs are making. And I'm sure they're all doing it in the spirit of trying to refine, improve the bill. But in the end, we'll be guided by you, the state legal advisor, law advisor, our legal person here in concluding the bill as it So I think we are really grateful to that. It's just that I was actually expecting more comments, more submissions. I mean, seven only be like this. I thought it's too little.
Very little.
And two, that the union has not commented.
Yeah.
I don't know. I hope they've seen it. We took a decision, a quite sober decision, that we will not publish this bill in that clouded period of the year, you know, the December time and so on. Because I know Kabin will be out of the country during that time. So we waited until he's back. And then we publish it.
I hope not in the Gupta country.
And then we publish it. Because we wanted to maximize the inputs into the process. Thanks so much, Peter, for what you've done. Colleagues, this is the thing, and you may ask just questions. We're not engaging on the page as it were. But before I do that, you may want to comment, Madam General, on the consultation part, and two, on any other parties you want to comment on. Remember, we're not dealing with the subset of the bill. I will grant you that opportunity. And from the Justice Department, you may also want to say a few things. But on the process, on the process, because the substantive issues are coming, and that is before I allow members to just ask questions. May I grant you the opportunity? I recognize you, Mr. Mare, after the two colleagues. Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. I'll start with the issues of consultation. You asked the question, whether this bill is the same bill that was there in 2012. What we'll say, yes, it is. But now I want to say this in the, that this bill was, now we say it's voluminous. It was huge. It was very huge because regulation, processes, and the text were in the same. The only thing that was done was definitely to break regulations aside, processes and procedures aside, and deal with them with the text. So, and there were also minor issues that state law advisors have not, that didn't really deal, I mean, affect the context as it went before, because those are, I mean, the minor issues on that part. So we want to say, yes, from 2010, I think this was started before 2008, if I'm not mistaken, it's a very long and stuff. So it's the same as that. But when it comes to the consultation, we are aware that the Reserve Force Council was consulted on certain level, but our consult my colleagues who dealt with us, with well, looking at the documentary, I mean, proof that no, at a certain level they made submission, but they made a second part. That's what I was told before I came here. Then another issue that I want to bring to the attention of the forum, is that some of the comments were made by the same people who drafted the bill. So if you look at the Majila comments, Majila and Pandavni worked with this bill from 2010. So now I'm not sure whether it's just redrafting the same. So I wanted to, I mean, to put them to look at that. Because the same comments that they make, in our view, the same, I mean, they should have definitely put those comments on this thing. So this bill has been out, in and out of military for, I mean, for a very long time. So I wanted to put that on that thing. Then on the other issues of consultations, we will definitely come back and look at why the Reserve Council and then consulted, in the 2012, which chapter, does that mean consultation, or does it mean no consultation? This is something that. On the other internal stakeholders, this bill has been in and out of the military command council, all the, the forums in this day. The advice was, only after the bill has been pre-certified or whatever, then the process can be followed and given to public, including members of the South African National Defence Force, to participate in their stuff. Because we're told on two issues, either you can do the, I mean, the public comment after cabinet has approved before it goes for the legislative process, or you can do after it has been introduced at the legislative, I mean, at the legislative process. And we opted for the second one. That's not public comment, including members now of the South African National Defence Force as individuals, were to be encouraged to participate, and they were encouraged to participate. So when it comes to members, that so where we have to get in clarity is the Reserve Force Council as one of the stakeholders. Yes, on any other processes, DEFCOM, clusters, whatever, the processes were, those processes were followed up until it was this year. But what we want to say, we accept this comment, and really they were made to assist this August Forum to legislate correctly for the country. We will, as you say, sir, we will respond, and when we say that, you know, there's nothing, we just say accept, and then we allow you to take that. Where we need to clarify certain issues, why this concept was came about, then we will definitely put that. And those are issues. I'm not going to really get down, because as you say, you just said the process, not on the peace process. So it's a mixture.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Actually, as you say, we're not dealing with the substantive issue before. So what our role would be is we will assist the department, and we also work together with the parliamentary advisor. We try to refine the bill as much as possible. So that's just really our role in the parliamentary process.
No, thank you so much. That helps to understand what food person and the role of food of the players in the process. Thank you, Mr. Mara.
I think it's just a, maybe a few more rather observations that I want to make. I find it, especially in the environment of a military organization, that one would think that it's advisable to deal with internal leadership structures the same as if they are just one of the public who must submit their concerns. We know that doesn't happen because of ranks and various structures and the way that the military organization works. So I think it's disingenuous to ignore, because we have got people with lieutenant generals ranks in here. So it's not the rank and file that we are talking about. I accept if it's the ordinary member of the Defence Force, the 75,000. But we're not talking about the 75,000. It seems like there was not even proper consultation with leadership in the Defence Force. I can tell you, I've had concerns raised with me, which I haven't used, which I haven't publicly made, and I haven't even mentioned it, I might have mentioned it to you, where people have said to me, listen, this process, it's like, you know, the internal of the internal of the internal of the internal connected that has drafted this, with very little or no consultation whatsoever. I think it's imperative for us, if we must give credibility to this process, first of all the process, and secondly this piece of legislation or bill or the draft, that we must know if we can get a complete list of your internal consultation processes and that you have used. We know that, you know, so if anybody that comes to us and says we haven't been consulted, then we can say, but this is the list. Somebody is lying to us then. If they claim it has been consulted, you say you haven't been consulted. The second one is, my understanding of any bill is the version in front of you. So if you have in 2012 consulted with the Reserve Force Council on a version that is different to this one, I think anybody in the legal fraternity would agree it's a different version, it's a different bill. You can't use certain portions of a bill to say it's still the same. It's either entirely different or entirely the same. It cannot be the same because certain portions are the same. So that's also wrong to their claim that they have consulted with it. That is my observation. The other thing is, while the submission is there will be no financial implications, it is quite clear from within the Defence Force themselves, in terms of at least the ministerial task team, has pointed out a number of occasions about money. So how on earth did they arrive to the conclusion that there will be no financial implications? How on earth, if they have consulted with everybody, that there will be no financial implications? Yeah, but I mean, again, you know, there's contradictory evidence from within the Defence Force fraternity themselves. So that sounds very contradictory, and I would agree with you that my observation is seven submissions, it doesn't sound, you know, that it's a thorough process. And as we've read through this, and we will wait for...
It doesn't give you a good running for the salary opinion.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not, and I will admit that. That's why the submission from Wilhelm will be very informative, because then we will go more in detail. This is already... It's only about red flags to me. It's only about red flags, and even it seems like there's a contradiction with the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. And we know that that's the supreme law. So anything that is even perceived to be in contradiction of the Constitution must be a huge red flag. So this process, my plea with you is, let's do this properly, but let's give credibility to the process. No one wants to be associated with something that sounds like a Bundu court matter. The other thing that I have picked up here, it seems like, and that we also need clarity from our legal advisors, whether a military discipline process have got jurisdiction over civilians.
No, you're on the substance.
Yeah.
The substance, that time is coming.
Yeah.
Anyone wants to comment on the process?
Yeah. Then, Chairperson, just to try and understand, if somebody has submitted a written submission and still wants to come and present.
All right.
Is it up to the committee to decide whether the submission is enough? Or must that person be given a chance? Whose prerogative is it? Because I'm just thinking already of what your submission. What do you want? Do you want cameras of this time? What would be the aim? You think we can't understand what you have written or what's your problem? Yeah, that's just to try and understand that. But as I was thinking aloud, usually in the military, when you come with a question of discipline, usually it's the command structure trying to have control over the rank and file. That's how it usually happens in military. So I'm just thinking you're going to ask, well, I understand it applies to, discipline applies to everybody, from the highest to the lowest. So if the rank and file was not consulted, there was no public participation from their side, would that be illegal? I mean, I'm going to ask the person how I must come and control him. He mustn't say that. I'm in charge. I'm the general here. So if it doesn't happen that way, would that be illegal? Thank you, Jefferson.
Any other? All right. The House has already voted because we are now in the parliamentary process. It's no longer within the department. But you can still assist us so that we try and what is the result that I've been looking for? Try the to remedy, not remedy. this actually escaped me. I think you took a decision, Major General, that when the bill has been in the parliamentary process, you would still be given an opportunity to make an input. All right. Can you facilitate that process of making it, bring it to the attention of the I don't know how you bring it to the notice of whoever. Rank and file, whatever. Yeah, to rank and file. And then invite them to make a submission and then collect it for us. It's just that it's out of the time now that we have given the public to make comments. But you don't treat your members of the public. You see, we are trying to make a special dispensation for the members.
because it's essentially about them. Not just about the general public. So, you know, the right spot where you bring things to members, yeah, to the attention of members, you put it there, you know, and then people just make comments. Two, if those comments could come with your comments as well, in other words, to analyze the comments and then present them to us. Maybe by then, if the comments are such that they influence you, right, to sponsor an amendment, right, we would still welcome the amendments, the proposals from the department. But you must know that when you do that, we are now at the mess of the committee to either say we accept this proposed amendment or not. In other words, we'll treat you now as, you know, people who are outside this process. We are at our mess. But obviously, because you are in the department, we usually give you a serious ear when it comes to listening. I don't know if that does not try and cure the thing. In other words, that's the general members, and also with the reserve council as well. Alright, bring it to their attention and say the opportunity to comment, collect the thing, comment on it, and then if you are persuaded, then propose amendments to the things that you have proposed, and you come and present it to the people. Colleagues, I think that's the way I think I'm proposing. I'm proposing that we try and cure the thing that has been pointed out to us. Honourable Martin?
Thank you, Chairperson. I remember I heard you talking about the unions. So if they exist in there,
My apology, Mr. Maga, okay,
you
what you were saying.
Over to you, sir. No, I was saying we seem to be silent about the unions. Yeah, the ones that are going to be talking too much in relation to the act itself. Because most of the times their complaints are related to discipline or something. So I was just thinking, we just keep quiet, or must they be reminded? Surely it's not a legal obligation that they must be talked to. But I think it's necessary, and I don't know at what stage do they come in. Do they come in when it's Parliament's time, or do they need to go and talk to them? But I think they need to say something. Even if it's just to say that, no, we don't have a comment. But I don't think you can just leave the unions as such. Unless if they don't qualify, there's that thing, they don't qualify to be unions, meaning that they are not unions anymore. But maybe a letter or a phone, or yeah, if you're still waiting here. Let's hear what they say. In writing.
No, it's fine. What Brian was proposing, contrary to one of my kids, input, is that let's give your members an option to send it directly to you. Those who may, others may actually send it to us as well. That is in case when we understand the culture. I mean, if the military, other people may not feel very much comfortable to break out. here we're not asking, it's not a breaking, of legs. It's people assisting us in making, in doing justice to the drafting process. All right? But others may be too rigid that what is placed before them, even though they may have some serious reservations, it's sufficient. All right? And but if you open up another avenue to say, okay, we'll submit, but others may also submit to the parliamentary committee. I don't know how we treat that one. Can you guide us on that one? But if, yeah, then one. But just before you mention to Nella, can we, I think other remark is correct as well. That as you bring it down to the general rank and file, as you bring it to the notice of the reserve force, you must also bring it to the notice, to the attention of the union as well. The unions, I think there are a few unions. Yeah, the unions within the department. Once you have spoken, you must then agree by when you want that to happen. And over to you, sir.
Sir, I will make a support, but I think if we say they must send the comments direct here, it would be proper. Because that's to manage the relations, because I don't think the union for assistance will be comfortable to send this thing to us. And also the rank and file, remember we are the people in the office enforcing discipline. So even if they want to openly say things that we do not hear, they cannot say those things. But if they send those things direct to you, then they can say everything, and then that will assist. I mean, someone who's completely out of the command line, they will take up the position.
Matthias, you also have a military structure there, I'm sure you can
find. Yeah, we've got the commander in chief. And we are structured on the same principle of the military.
Yeah.
Without which there can be no cohesion, there can be no discipline. And the prospects of infiltration is very high. I don't know why Honourable Mike is laughing. Because when they were operating as underground, as a Soviet underground operative, okay, right? They taught us what was called then 10 codes of political discipline. And they were structured along military discipline. So we militarized at a very young age by them. Well, I don't know about that. And I don't know if you know what ultra-nationalism is. So that is a new concept. Okay? That can be a debate for another day. It sounds a little bit problematic as I listen to Mr. Nishi. That is like maybe perhaps we need to get some clarity that the union in the army is not recognized. If it is recognized, it must come out clear that there is a recognition agreement between the military and the unions. They should not operate somewhere underground and all of that. So there must be a clear understanding, even the committee must have that understanding. Secondly, if they are recognized, they must be allowed to operate in an open environment without any fear of intimidation. Ours is a democracy.
I'm still talking in relation to the process.
Yeah.
Or I'm talking to
you now. No, in relation to the process. They should operate in an open environment in which that its representative can speak openly with management of the military or even with parliament, so that when they come here, they don't come here in balaclava. So let's get clarity about that. If there is indeed an existence of recognition activity, and if not, we should know. We should not expect to have people who will be making oral or written representation on behalf of soldiers in balaclava. That should not be encouraged. That's all I want to say.
Okay. All right. Colleagues, we agree that we'll bring this to the attention of the rank and file, we'll bring it to the attention of the reserve force, and we'll also bring it to the attention of the union is a recognized entity there. It's recognized, right?
Yep.
In terms of general regulations, they operate, and where I speak now, I know that in and out, but in terms of general regulations, they are allowed to move into the
local area. Okay. No, that's fine. So, all right. There will be no power travels.
Please.
Sure. Okay. Because if they are in power travels, they must also be in El Paraclava when they send this thing to them, you know? Okay, so to bring it brought to the attention. We then work out the letter under which that comes out. Whether it must come out under, you know, the notice letter, whether it's on our letter it or your letter it. But that's an administrative thing that you can work out between the two of you. Okay. What you think they may feel comfortable with, all right? So we'll do that. And yes, Madam?
Chair, sorry for the interruption, and perhaps Brian can advise you as well. You just have to make sure that the process cannot be challenged, that this is not considering reopening the input process for a selected group of people. Maybe it would be better to re-advertise the second round of public comments for public comment. But just perhaps for discussion in the committee, just to make sure that the process is not being challengeable at the end of the day.
That's right. We find they were for protecting it. Because they were trying to remedy to cure that they were not there wasn't sufficient consultation in Kenya. We are trying to cure that. And it's not that we are just opening it up. Alright, we're dealing with that particular aspect. But we'll see how we manage it with legal advice, the guidance. But in principle that's what we want to do. Alright, that's what we want to achieve. Alright? Any other thing? Before,
on the agenda, we are two other
colleagues, you are happy, Mr. General? Thank you. Department of Justice is happy, and I think we are all happy. On that note, let's adjourn the meeting until on the 26th. Thank you so much, colleagues.